on now. KJLL 1330 AM. Tune on in. Please listen up to some jazz interviews each week with the heavies. Don't you know? Pat Martino, George Duke, John Hurt, Dick Burke, Al Gaffa, Nat Hentoff. The Jake Feinberg Show, it's on now. On KJLL 1330 AM. Everybody inside the studios of KJLL 1330 The Jolt. This is the Jake Feinberg program. And, you know, throughout this trip that I've been on, I've encountered all types of different cats. Guys that have, occupied Hungary during World War II, and they took a boat over to the eastern seaboard of the United States. Europeans who played music that would be considered jazz in Europe and eventually immigrated over to the United States. And everybody has their own stories and their own unique travels. And my guest today is no different. He was originally from Europe, and on his way to the Caribbean islands, he had a stopover and wound up at Bop City, where he had a chance to watch George Shearing and Lionel Hampton, more specifically, play Vibes, some sort of improvisational 10-bar medley on Stardust. After that, his life was changed, and he found he got himself a set of Vibes and practiced. And his new album, it's not a new album, but it's an album that's about to be re-released, it caught my eye, The Lost Sessions of 1974. And the people on this album are all Hall of Famers. Slam Stewart, Zoot Sims, Hank Jones, and Mel Lewis. And my guest, I'm honored to welcome, from Canada, Peter Appleyard. Peter, welcome to the Jake Feinberg Show.
Oh, thanks, Benjamin. That was very interesting to hear those comments.
Just to be clear, Benjamin is my producer. My name is Jake Feinberg.
Jake. Jay. Oh, Jake. Yeah, that's a familiar name.
Jake. So, yeah, but Peter, it's great to, it's really, I mean, I was stunned when I even saw the re-release. How did, can you talk a little bit about how this thing kind of dusted off the rusty strings and got it out into the marketplace again?
Well, it's rather a long story. I was playing Carnegie Hall with Benny Goodman on the 13th of that particular month. And on the 14th, I had to play a concert up here. And this was the only time that Benny Goodman had got these guys together. Hank Jones, Slam Stewart, Irby Green, Zoot Sims, Bobby Hackett. And it was the only time. And I asked them if they were available the following night to play the concert with me in Canada, in Toronto. And fortunately, they were all available except the drummer, and so consequently I called Mel Lewis to come and play for us, and it turned out to be a wonderful concert. And whilst I was playing the concert, I checked with the local RCA Victor studio to see if they were available at around about 11 p.m. at night after we finished the concert for an open-ended session. Because I knew this was just one time. It was the only time that Goodman could have ever used them all, because they were all individually so busy, because
exactly.
They were so famous.
Right.
So we all went over there, got a couple of bottles of wine or whatever, and some Chinese food, and we started to record. And I said to them, each one of them, choose a number you'd like to play individually, and then we'll do two or three standards that we can do together. And that's basically how it happened. It was, I tried, once it was done, I made enough to take it with me to England with Benny to see a man at Philips Record Company about taking it. And unfortunately, the American artists which were, they all were in Goodman's sixth set at the time except me, didn't have their correct working permit in order. So we all got held up at the border, and I got held up with them. And I'd arranged to see this fellow that particular evening, and unfortunately I didn't get to see him. So that sort of fell through the window, and a couple of other people I didn't get to that I wanted to see. And so anyway, there was another situation that sort of made me keep it on the back burner. It was a divorce thing. And so eventually I introduced it to this record company, and they were thrilled to hear about it, and so they put it out.
You know, I just wanted to go back. You know, you talk about Hank Jones, and we lost him 2 years ago, and Zoot Sims and Irby Green, and you know, these guys, like you said, they were all stars. But
oh, yes.
How did stars act, you know, back then? I look at entertainment today. I'm, 33 years old, a young father, about to be a father again. And I look at the sports athletes of today and the so-called music entertainers of today. And, you know, they're suing each other for $10 million, $20 million, divorces, a bunch of crap.
Yeah.
And it's like, the idea of ordering a couple of things, you know, some lo mein and some Chinese and a couple of bottles of wine, and you're dealing with heavy hitters. How did heroes back then?
You mean behavior?
Yeah, well, I mean, like how were they treated? Talk a little bit about the substance over the fluff that we have now.
Well, for instance, Hank Jones was very busy in the recording studios. At the time, and was undoubtedly almost a genius. Well, I would say a genius of piano playing. He was one player that would play a solo when I hired him, and I had him two or three times. The musician would literally stand in the wings listening to him play. Mm. It's very rarely that you get musicians that are well-rounded doing that. He was treated very well by the people that employed him, although he could be, on the odd occasion, a little bit unreliable for some reasons or other. Maybe he got in a better engagement or what, I don't know. But we did an album called Barbados Heat and Barbados Cool, and he was hired to be on it. And I called him. He was at Carnegie Hall a couple of nights before we left. And I said, "Hank's everything okay?" "Oh, everything is fine." You know. So we get to the airport, and we've been put up overnight. He didn't show up for the hotel and didn't show up for the plane. And we got to Barbados, where they'd been advertising him for about 5 or 6 months, I think. And he wasn't there, and everyone was very disappointed, and I had to make an excuse. I don't know what happened. Then we managed to locate him, and he said, his car broke down on the way to the airport.
Jesus.
Then I booked him in Switzerland, and he wasn't there when I got there, and I called him, "Hey, what happened?" He said, "I didn't like the way the man treated me at the desk."
So he was
anyway, he came a couple of days later, but, you know, you basically accepted it because... he was prone to do that once in a while. Slam Stewart was one of the nicest individuals I've ever met. Such a charming man. And he was the one that created all this hip language, if you will, this vouty and cool. You know, he was a real character. And he composed a song called The Flatfoot Floogie with a Floy.
A lot of alliteration on that.
I'm sorry?
A lot of alliteration.
Yes, yeah. That's right. Mel Lewis, of course, he had his own big band, as you know, and that was one of the very few times that I'd used him. What happened at Carnegie Hall that night before, about a month before it was set up, Goodman and I were pretty close, and he said to me, "You know, I heard a drummer last night, Connie Kaye, a very nice drummer." Mm-hmm. And at the time, we were using Grady Tate. Mm-hmm. I said, "Oh, yeah, he's a nice drummer." I said, "But I really love Grady Tate." So So Goodman said, well, I tell you what we'll do. When we play Carnegie Hall, you can have, when you play, you can have Grady Tate. When I play, I'll have Connie Kay.
I love it.
You know, what I used to do is open up for him about 10, 15 minutes, you know, so... Anyway,
I wanted to, we're talking to Peter Appleyard. We're going to get into the music of the Lost 74 sessions, but I got to go back to an earlier time here. You had the privilege of the fortuitous, serendipitous bounce of being able, you had a stopover, you missed a flight and wound up at Bob City to see George Shearing playing with Lionel Hampton. And at that time your life was forever changed because you saw Lionel doing improvisation on the vibraphone. So my first question is twofold question here. What instrument were you playing prior to that? And at that time, was George Shearing, I know you were on your way to the Caribbean. So my question is, was George Shearing incorporating the Afro-Cuban, the conga drum in his bands at that point, or was he doing the Afro-Cuban thing at that time?
First of all, the answer to that question, it was Edmondo Peraza that he used on Congress, and no, he wasn't at that time.
Okay.
I was familiar with his playing in England. I saw him actually, I think it was around, 1948. No, it wasn't, because I remember it was the time the atomic bomb was dropped. It's 45. I saw him in 1945 with... Stefan Grappelli at the place called the Chiswick Empire.
Oh.
And he was renowned in Britain then, but he came to America and was fascinated with the bebop music, and he encountered the agent, very famous agent. His name will come to me. He had a son that played folk music. Excuse me for a moment. I'm having a senior moment. This the agent that put this group together. Oh, wait a minute. No, it was Leonard Feather, I think, that put the group together.
Okay.
Yes, it was Leonard Feather suggested to George that they use the vibraphone with the piano. And George started playing that lock-handed style. And the three of them played in unison together. And that was the group at the time. He had a lady playing the vibes called Margie Himes.
Yes,
I saw.
And was Al McKibben on bass?
Yeah, she was a great player. Mm. But I think she's still in Chicago. And Hampton was the star attraction, I guess, because George was just sort of coming up then at the Bop City. I did play drums before this.
Mm.
And during the Second World War, I was entertaining troops as a drummer in an accordion band. And one night, this guy came in with a little tiny vibraphone, about 2 octaves long, and played a solo with one hand and strummed a guitar with the other. I don't know how he did it, but it was pretty bad act, but of course the war was on. And so I asked him to sell me it. He said, no, I can't sell it. Anyway, the war ended. And, of course, as Second World War, and a knock came at my door, and it was this little man, and he said, you still want to buy the vibraphone? I said, yes, I'd love to. He said, well, it's £15. Well, in those days, I was an apprentice compass adjuster and nautical instrument maker, which was a good trade to have for a young man that left public school and went to acquire a trade to the local port. And I was only making 7 shillings and 6 pence a week, so £15 was a king's ransom.
Sure.
And I borrowed the money, and that was it. And I started to practice it as best I could and adopted the piano technique for the right hand for the vibraphone. Nobody could teach me because there was very few people around that played it. Anyway, about 10 years ago, I went back to look up this dear old man. And he said, I want to tell you why I couldn't sell you the vibraphone now during the war. I said, why? He said, well, I was a British spy, and the vibraphone was a cover for me. I said, well, what happened? He said, well, you remember when we used to play the aerodromes? I said, yes. He said, well, if you recall, I never went home with you.
Hmm.
What would happen? They'd take me to a single-engine aircraft, and they'd fly me behind the German lines. we'd meet the Maquis, the French resistance, and they'd guide me down with flashlights, and we'd switch off the engine for about a mile back so the Germans couldn't hear us, and we'd exchange information. It was very much prior to the invasion. I said, Mr. Blakey, how many times did you do that? He said, oh, over a dozen times.
Oh, my.
You know what happens if you get caught doing that?
Oh, yeah. You're done.
So that's how I got it. If the guy hadn't needed a vibraphone or a cover, and the way I began to get into the profession was very funny, too. When I was an apprentice comfort adjuster, I used to have to go to the city of Grimsby and pick up admiralty charts for the naval vessels to circumvent our minefields in the River Humber. And on the way to this place where I pick up the charts, there was a record shop, and I used to stop at the record shop and audition a couple of records,
mm-hmm.
which you could in those days. You could go in a little booth and play them, you know, and come back out and say, I'd like to get the Benny Goodman Quartet record, and so and so and so and so. Anyway, one day, here I am tapping away with a pair of drumsticks with this record, and there's a little window in the booth, and this chap popped his head around the corner of the door. He says, hey, old fellow. He said, do you play the drums? I said, yeah. He said, if you'd like to come and audition for our band on Saturday at the Palace Theater, there's a job available. I said, well, what happened? Well, he said, the drummer got caught in bed last night with another woman by his wife.
Oh, boy.
And she promptly took the fire axe and chopped up his drums.
if he's lucky, she took his drums.
I'm sorry?
If he was lucky, she chopped up his drums and not anything else.
That's right. Yeah, I've often thought about that. The band, by the way, was called Felix Mendelssohn's Hawaiian Serenaders. It was like a Hawaiian band with saxophones
well, that's,
and everything.
You know, Peter,
and they paid me £15 a week. So naturally, I took the job.
One man gathers what another man spills, so to speak.
That's right.
Hey, you know, my question here is, you know, let's just say you never made it. You were going to the Caribbean. Were you playing? What was the intention for going down there? Were you playing the sort of Hawaiian style, sort of calypso music?
No, I was playing in a dance band that was formed in Britain and for the Princess Hotel in Bermuda. And I'd got an offer to go there. By the fellow that got me the job with Mendelssohn, as a matter of fact, and it was an 18-month contract, and I wanted to come over to the States. Naturally, I couldn't afford it at the time, and take a look at the jazz scene, and also the opportunity to go to Bermuda for that length of time, because everything when I left Britain was still rationed, and petrol, and or rather gasoline, and all kinds of foods and clothing, and it looked pretty dismal in Britain. There wasn't much promising, and it seemed like the band business was diminishing, and so this was a good opportunity to be able to save some money and have a nice 18 months in the Caribbean.
And at that time, were you, you know, at that point, you know, the Conguero, the Armando Peraza, Mongol Santa Maria, was that prevalent in the islands? I mean, and then were you seeing a fusion of the Latin rhythms in the jazz idiom at that point, or?
Well,
go ahead.
It was, but it had been established already by Dizzy Gillespie.
Chano Pozzo.
Chano Pozzo, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that made its headway in, and George was, I think, the next one to incorporate it with a swing group.
I have to ask you if you ever crossed paths with a guy that has been in my soul on this whole trip, was a drummer like yourself, previously a drummer, and also and then became a very well-recognized vibraphone player, was Cal Jader.
Oh, yes, I knew Cal, yeah.
Could you talk, I mean, I've interviewed Herb Wong and I've interviewed, John Hurd and Dick Burke and all these guys that played with Cal. And could you spend a little bit of time talking about what he meant to you, your friendship with him, and what he brought to the table?
He used to come through with George. He played with George for a while,
right.
George Shearing. And he encouraged me to go to New York And we, you know, naturally, he came to the house for dinner two or three times, and we had that sort of a relationship. And I asked George who his favorite vibraphone player was of all the people that had played with him, including Gary Burton and all the guys. And he said Cal Jada.
He
was a school teacher originally, I believe. Also, he was the first drummer to record and play vibes with Dave Brubeck.
That's right. That's exactly the fascinating sounds and rhythm. I have that on a 10-inch. When you were in New York, did you wind up checking out some of the going to the Palladium and going to see Tito Puente and seeing those guys right when that sort of that rhythmic pulsating Latin beat was going on?
Oh yes, I was very friendly with Tito because I would play the Embers restaurant, which was on 53rd and 3rd Avenue, I think it was, something like that. And he would drive up in this huge big Cadillac with his gorgeous wife.
How many wives? One wife or how many wives?
Oh, I don't know how many wives he had. And she would come to say, and she'd come up to the bandstand and say, "Peter, have you any mallet? Have you any mallet? Give Peter some mallet."
Mallets.
And then I went to the Palladium several times and sat in with the band. And then the last time he came through here, I played bongos with him. I sat down on bongos, and they were laughing. He was laughing at me because I didn't have the strength in my hands. They weren't hardened like the guys that played bongos and congas. Usually with the Emendo Peraza showed me, he would put adhesive tape on his hands.
You know, I talked to a lot of congueros, Ray Mantilla and Chief Bay I haven't talked to Armando, but you know, those guys, I mean, you could cut your hands open, cut your fingers, be bloody.
Oh yeah,
you know, just
you
by
had to
banging.
Be careful.
Oh my God, I mean, it was just, I even on my hand drum, I mean, when I start really hitting it, I can feel that if I did it for any extended period of time, I'd get blisters too. It's really.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
You know, it's funny you bring up the Embers restaurant because that is where one of a dear friend of the show and a good friend and a brilliant pianist, Mike Longo, used to play there.
And, that's right. Yeah, he did. Yeah.
And that's actually where Dizzy Gillespie discovered him as well, and kind of brought him in under his wing as well. So, Peter Appleyard, we got so much to do as we go to. No, we'll actually save the music clip till after the break. But you know, I just want to say it's really nice for me to be able to talk to guys like yourself. You know, European blood, spent a lot of time in the States. Now you're in Canada, and to be able to talk about the music that I love so much with people that are diverse. Because it is so important in we're becoming more diverse in this country and all over the United States and in the Western Hemisphere and Canada as well. And I really believe that percussion, mallet instruments, vibraphones, congas, bongos, timbales, they're missing now in jazz music, and it's taken away an urban feel and a slickness and actually an appeal for a younger generation. So I love having vibes players on my program. And
thank you. It is becoming an endangered species. I mean, it always was to a certain extent, and there are several reasons, probably. One, primarily, it's not used very much today in
Peter, I don't want to rush your answer. Hold that, and we'll come back. We're going to take a break. Come back on the other side, do a whole lot more, okay?
All right.
All right, we'll be back in just a little bit.
This is the Jake Feinberg Show. We'll be right back.
Thank you. Folks, this is Jake Feinberg. When it came time to decide where to buy my daughter a piano last year, the choice was easy. We got it at Hackenberg & Sons Piano Company. Located at 4333 East Broadway Boulevard, Hackenberg & Sons is Tucson's longest-running family-owned piano business. Run by three brothers and a son, they pride themselves on superior instruments and customer satisfaction. It's why they've been around so long. And it's why their pianos are used at the University of Arizona, Pima Community College, and many other prestigious institutions. So whether it's for your child, business, or yourself, when you buy a piano, make sure you go to Hackenberg & Sons. It'll be the beginning of a long-lasting partnership. For more information, visit them at HackenbergPiano.com.
Duke Ellington's inspired metaphor, "Dig not the distortion," got my wheels turning. If you think the sun has set on the golden age of hi-fi, stop the presses. Stereo Hospital is the light at the end of the tunnel. At 4044 East Speedway, it is your oasis in the desert of broken stereo dreams. Whether it's a dead silent amp or a broken needle, owner Jeff Brucker does it all, from the heavy lifting to the icing on the cake. A guaranteed, quick, and reasonably priced repair will put you back on the sunny side of the street. We know that music has charms to soothe the savage beast, so don't cast your old components to the winds. Visit us on the web at stereohospital.com or find us inside the Metronome Music Store, east of Alvernon at 4044 East Speedway. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the defense rests.
Brought to you by Mixed Metaphors. Folks, this is Jake Feinberg. One of the first things I wanted to do when I moved to Tucson was find authentic Chinese cuisine. After a tip from the Chinese Student Association, I headed over to Badar Chinese Restaurant. Well, it's been 7 years, and I have never looked back. Located at 7321 East Broadway Boulevard, Badar has been a family-run operation since 1992. The award-winning chef produces succulent dishes from sizzling ginger chicken to salt and pepper shrimp. The thing that separates Badar from the rest is that the chef procures ancient oriental dishes with the exotic island flair of Taiwan. Most importantly, there are no gimmicks or razzle-dazzle at Badar. You won't find any flat-screen TVs or karaoke machines. Badar is a place to go enjoy good food and spend time with your family. It exudes peace and tranquility after a long week of work. So come down and check out Badar Chinese Restaurant. Hung Hao Chu. It's that good. In this day and age, people have a lot to protect. You want to know that when you're insuring valuable goods, you have an agent you can trust. Craig Pretzinger is that agent. For auto, home, and life insurance, the Pretzinger Agency is Tucson's most honest and flexible insurance company. Have off-road vehicles or motorhomes? Pretzinger can cover that as well. Pretzinger Agency at 299-5810, located across the street from Sullivan Steakhouse on the southwest corner of River and Campbell. Trust, compassion, and service. The whole package at Pretzinger Agency. Call 299-5810 or text QUOTE to 602-459-5533 to receive a no-obligation quote. If you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. Be a part of a new coalition with Jake Feinberg. The second half of my show starts right now. Welcome back, everybody, to the Jake Feinberg Show. And we're joined by legendary percussionist and vibes player Peter Appleyard. Peter, I didn't mean to cut you off before, so talk a little bit about why the vibes are becoming an endangered species and how do we, reinstitute it back into a musical setting.
I didn't hear the last part of your question. There was sort of a beep, and your volume went down a bit.
My question was, how can we reintegrate such a beautiful sounding instrument into live music settings?
It's very difficult because primarily, as you know, the instrumentation of the groups today are guitars and a bass and a drummer. They are carrying percussion. It hasn't played a prominent role as such. There are a few guys playing. For instance, this morning I heard this gentleman, Joe Locke. I've never met him or seen him play, but he played a wonderful instrument, very avant-garde. I've sweetened numerous sessions. I did do a track or two with the Bay City Rollers. I don't even remember that.
Of course, that's great. That's great.
And Marvin Gaye, I played for him when he came by.
Wow.
It is unfortunate, though. There are two reasons. One, the instrument, to buy a good instrument, you're looking at around about $7,000 or $8,000.
Yeah, 15 pounds back in the day seems relatively small compared to now.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
And then, of course, you have to have a van or a vehicle that's big enough to move it around, and you really can't carry it because it weighs about 20 pounds. I, fortunately, when I travel, and I'm still doing quite a bit of traveling, I just got back from Switzerland, my second tour this year there, last year. This last one was with Bucky Pizzarelli.
Oh, wow.
I have friends there that loan me instruments. England, I've got access to an instrument. And I'm playing in Florida this coming, the 31st and the 1st of February in Lakeland. And I have a friend down there who is the manager, sort of business manager for Dick Hyman, who I play with quite a bit as a duo. He loans me his instrument, so that's pretty good. But that's probably one reason. And also, it hasn't really been featured that much. I would think that if somebody came along in one of these rock groups and got a hit with a vibraphone, it would sort of reestablish its prominence. But of all the instruments, too, it's the youngest instrument. It's actually, it's 83 years old this year, I believe, that instrument. It was invented.
You know, I was going to say, the idea of you talked about it earlier, and it's this beautiful, and we're going to listen to a track in a minute, but the idea of the vibraphone with the piano, and you talked about that, I think it's maybe Benny was the one that made that Lionel Hampton was playing with George at that time.
No, Lionel wasn't playing with George.
But they recommended that it would sound good, vibes with a piano.
Oh, yes. I think it was Leonard Feather that
Leonard
came up with.
And that, I completely agree. I mean, whereas maybe with keyboard and guitar, it's a little more difficult, vibes and keyboards just mesh perfectly. And
well, the first major player that I heard after Lionel was Red Norvo, and at the time he was using
Tal Farlow
on guitar and Charlie Mingus on bass. And that I was up to Canada from Bermuda on vacation. So I went back and put a group together with a couple of local guys, and we rehearsed. I like playing with the guitar. The timbre of the two instruments and vibes go together very well, as with the clarinet. So, it was Benny, of course, that first gave Lionel that exposure with the quartet and then the sextet. And it was basically that sound from the sextet with Lionel playing when I was a kid, a teenager, inspired me to eventually connect with the vibraphone.
Well, let's we've done a lot of talking. Let's check out a couple of one track here from this soon to be released album, The Lost Sessions 1974 with Peter Appleyard. Let's take a listen and we'll come back and talk about it.
Okay.
We used Herpes oil on the pedal, huh?
Right. Can you hear any squeaks?
No.
You go to my head, take 20.
Wouldn't it be funny if you used the Elmer's glue instead?
That's what this is, Elmer's glue.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I Peter, first off, I want to apologize because I was listening in the car today, and I really thought you took a vibe solo on that tune. I don't know why, but...
No, on the ballad medley, the Duke Ellington medley, it's the first one that I play, Sophisticated Lady. That was Zoot Sims with Hank Jones and Slam and Mel Lewis.
I mean, well, you know, in some ways, it's really just... You know, everybody was just so relaxed, and
yeah.
And I'm like, I guess, did you? Obviously, were you really on take 20, or was that just a? Were you being facetious there?
Well, take 20 was not on that particular song. It had been the preamble. You know, the I stopped Sophisticated Lady at the beginning, and a couple of things, and I think there was a couple of other songs before Zoot played that. So that's how it came to. 20. You know, as the evening goes on, you the takes mount up, and that's how come it seems to be like a high number, but it wasn't. That was the first take that Zoo played, and that was it.
And what was the reference to Elmer's glue?
Oh, it's like sticking together. That was Zoo that was speaking. We left that in just to let the people hear. We thought it'd be kind of cute on the record to do that.
Oh, I think it's great. I what I love the most, I'm like, wow, there's a lot of music on this. And actually, many of those tracks are excerpts of just you guys, you know, talking and developing chemistry. And it's really, and just feeling comfortable with each other and getting stuff out of your system. I think that is so nice because oftentimes you just listen to six tracks on a record and it's the music, but you don't hear the kind of the rapport.
Now, but Bobby Hackett... was a little guy, and it was mentioned in the liner notes. We were coming through the customs and immigration in Toronto, and so the guy said to him, the customs man, who recognized them all, he said, "Are you all American citizens?" And Bobby said, "Yeah," and this one's senior. And then he said, "Well, Peter, what are you going to call this band?" I said, "Well, I guess I should call it, I think I'll call it the Jazz Giants." So Bobby Hackett, who was only about 5'3", said, "Well, in that case, if you're going to call it the Jazz Giants, when I get to Toronto, I better go out and buy a pair of high-heeled shoes."
Right. Or some stilts.
Yeah.
Hey, I want to, you know, I'm looking right now. I mean, I'm going to buy this. I'm going to go after this album on vinyl as soon as possible, though. I'm figuring it's probably a pretty pricey record. 1958, Peter Appleyard, The Vibe Sound.
Oh, that, I don't think, we might be able to make some copies. I think I've got the masters somewhere.
It was,
I'll make a note of that.
Well, no, thank you. You know what it is, Peter? I have a few questions. It was recorded, the release date was October 1958. Could you tell me the personnel who you played with and the record company that got you hooked up with that?
That on that record?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, I used to use various people, but I know for one person who's on that is Whitey Mitchell on bass,
mm-hmm.
who is Red's brother.
Wow. Whitey, I only know. See when you said Red Norvo and you used Mingus, I'm familiar with Norvo with Red Mitchell, but I never even knew Whitey was part of the crew.
Yeah, Whitey used to carry a card around, and all it said on it was, "Yes, I am Red's brother."
Yeah.
Yeah, he used to play for me, and Bobby, somebody or other on piano, I really don't remember. And then we did use two other vibraphone players on the part of that Vibe Sound.
Who was it?
One was, he died very early. Very good vibraphone player. He got killed on the highway, on the West Side Highway, I think.
Mm. Well, I'll have to do some research. And then, and the other one was who?
You know, I can't remember.
Well, yeah, and I'm pushing you back about half a century here, so you know,
I can't remember where I put my keys.
There's another beautiful, one of my favorite jazz tunes, and you guys covered it. on the Lost Sessions. I'd like to play another clip of music, and we'll come back. Okay.
Yeah.
Rolling tape, but beautiful take 19.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah, that's Irby Green, yeah. Beautiful. Amazing. Several people said, are you sure he's not playing a flugelhorn?
I exactly. The whole time I'm thinking, that's a beautiful trumpet solo, and then I had no idea it was Irby playing Bowen.
Yeah.
I just want to read something for the audience. This is about Peter Appleyard, how significant a role he's played in moving forward and the foresight to push jazz, or whatever you want to call it, into the forefront. It says, Appleyard had the foresight to, well, let me go back to this. He has hosted CBC radio shows and even had his own television program, Peter Appleyard Presents, syndicated throughout North America. Peter, real simply, why do these programs, why have they gone away from public television? Why has it shrunk up? I mean, to me, this is so important for opening minds, knowledge, and compassion, and love, and teamwork, and exactly things that we should be focusing on as a society now. What's your take on why some of these more holistic programs have dried up?
Well, I think it's a matter of a bottom-line situation with a lot of it, and plus the fact of the advent of the music of rock and roll. It's a tragedy because I traveled internationally with Benny Goodman, and the reception that we received when we traveled, and this is in the 70s, was just incredible, especially in Europe. And even in North America, whenever I played with Benny, it was sold right out and wonderful reception. It is sad because it's part of your heritage in America. It's basically, jazz music is the only major true art form that came out of America. And it's something that I was shocked to find that it wasn't as acknowledged and recognized as I expected to be when I originally came to America. I would frankly rather see statues of Count Basie and Duke Ellington and all these great people that contributed so much than seeing former warriors on horses with swords. But that's another matter.
Well, I'd say there should be a balance to be struck, you know, and I even was talking to the great drummer Jabali Billy Hart yesterday, and he said that in his mind, someone like Herbie Hancock it wouldn't happen, but he should be the president of the United States with his vision and his foresight and his ability to know that he could have, you know, it's this idea of restraint, knowing that you are successful, knowing that you are successful monetarily, but also sharing and being able to coalesce and build coalitions and give people a semblance of speaking about love and truth, the way Coltrane did as well. I mean, there was just, it was a different generation, and it's one of the major reasons I continue to build this archive. Peter, before we go real quick, did you ever have a chance to play with Pete Magadini up in Canada?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I used him on many occasions. And he's a great percussionist. As a matter of fact, I loaned him some information for him to acquire his doctorate, I think, in music.
Of course. Well, Pete was one of my early guests on the program, and we did a whole thing on the Ali Akbar Khan School of Music and his writing and his great playing as well. So. But Peter, I got to tell you, I'm thrilled we had this opportunity, and I look forward to collaborating with you in the future, my friend.
Oh, I thank you very much. And just before you go, quickly, can you give me your address so I can send you my playing on? Beautiful.
You hang on the phone, and after we go to break, I'll get that to you. Okay.
Okay, and thanks again for the opportunity of being on your show. I really enjoyed it very much indeed.
Me too, my friend. And we'll talk in a minute. This is the Jake Feinberg Show, everybody, and we'll see you next week. Send them shine.